parents would continue to rush into our room as they had the night of the first quake. But as the aftershocks continued, the responses grew slower, until finally they stopped getting up to check on us at all. After that, the three of us would rush into their room. In the midst of yet another aftershock, we kids thundered into their room, launched ourselves airborne from the foot of the bed, and heard the whump of air escape our parents' lungs as we landed on top of them. My dad, obviously tiring of this sort of thing awakening him in the middle of the night, heard my mom's exhortations to do something, Mike, and decided to put a stop to it once and for all. Getting out of bed, naked again, but by then we'd grown used to it, he suddenly performed what resembled an Indian rain dance in the middle of the bedroom. Waving his arms, he spun in circles, chanting, "Stop, earthquake! Stop, oh yay, mighty earthquake! Be gone!" And in the moment that he stopped circling and chanting, the earth suddenly stopped shaking. All we could do was stare at him. We were awestruck as he crawled back into bed and shooed us from the room. I don't suppose I need to explain the significance of such an event to young minds. And after we crawled under the covers in our own beds, my brother and I understood exactly what this meant. Coincidence? I think not. As Micah explained solemnly, "Our dad has magic powers." This, of course, made us see our father in a completely different light, a new, exciting light. And I must say that when I got back to school, I wasn't reticent in sharing this information with others in my class. They, too, were amazed. In addition to stopping earthquakes, my father was also able to stop the rain from falling. Not all the time, mind you, but only when we were driving in the car, and only for a little while. It didn't matter how hard the rain might be coming down, but as we hurtled down the highway, my dad would glance over his shoulder and sometimes ask us if we were ready for the rain to stop. If we said yes, he'd tell us to close our eyes, remind us not to peek, and then in the moment that he said stop, the rain would stop falling. It would be utterly quiet for about a second, the roar against the roof completely silenced, and then, just as suddenly, we'd hear the rain begin to pound again. As he explained, it takes a lot of energy to stop the rain. I can't keep it up for long. It wasn't until a few years later that I noticed my father only seemed to have these powers when we were approaching a highway overpass. In 1972, things began to change in our family. With my sister now in kindergarten, my mother started working, so after school we found ourselves alone. We had an older neighbor who was supposed to look in on us, but she seldom did. Instead, we'd head up to her apartment, tell her that we were home, then ignore her for the rest of the afternoon. This suited her perfectly. She was more of the contact in case of only dire emergencies, lest I miss my soap operas kind of babysitter. And besides, we'd been on our own in the afternoons for so long by then that we didn't really need someone to watch over us. Unsurprisingly, my brother and I suffered an exceedingly high number of injuries during our early years. Already I'd had my head cut open by a rock thrown by a teenager, which not only involved the police, but a visit by my father to said teen, where the teen was threatened with grave bodily harm if it ever happened again. Lost a couple of teeth while learning to ride a bicycle, sprained both wrists and both ankles, and nearly cut my finger off with a piece of broken glass. My brother had the same types of injuries. Only, if anything, they were more frequent and serious. Yet with the exception of required vaccinations, we children were seldom taken to see doctors or dentists. By seldom, what I mean is maybe once in our lives, and only then if there was a better than even chance that we might die. I was 18 years old before I ever set foot in a dentist's office. I sometimes wondered how much blood I'd actually have to lose before my parents finally broke down and brought me to a clinic. They had no religious reasons for avoiding medical care. They simply believed that seeking medical attention would not only be a waste of time, but more costly than they could afford. Add in the requirement to be tough, and the only doctors my brother and I saw were on television. I remember, for instance, that after I was struck by the rock, blood literally gushed over my face. I couldn't see well and was barely able to stagger home. "You'll be fine tomorrow," my mother said after taking a look at it. "You've got a thick skull." Luckily, I did indeed have a thick skull and was able to heal on my own. It was around that time, however, that my sister developed epiglottitis, a potentially fatal inflammation of the epiglottis. Neither Micah nor I knew exactly what was wrong with my sister that morning. All we knew was that my sister was burning up with fever, pale, delirious, and had vomited through the night. My parents, who knew a real emergency when they saw one, rushed her to the hospital. Unfortunately, without health insurance, the hospital required a deposit of $200, and after dropping the family off, my dad sped off in search of someone to lend him the money. My mom went into the hospital with my sister. She told my brother and me to wait near a tree at the edge of a parking lot. "Don't go beyond here, there, and there," she pointed, outlining an imaginary box about 12 feet square. Even at that age, we recognized the fear in her voice and knew enough to do exactly as she said. It was hot that day, probably close to 100 degrees. We'd been left with neither food nor water, and to keep our minds off the heat, we spent the next few hours climbing the tree or walking just inside the lines of the imaginary box. We made a game of getting as close to the imaginary lines as we could without stepping over. At one point, I stumbled and fell over the line. I remember standing quickly, but the thought that I'd disobeyed my mom, coupled with the stress that we were under, brought me to tears. As always, in situations like these, my brother was there to comfort me, and with his arm around me, we sat for what seemed interminable hours in the shade. "Do you think Dana will die?" I asked eventually. "No," he said. "What's wrong with her?" "I don't know." "Then how do you know she won't die?" "Because she won't. I just know it." I glanced at him. "Mom looks scared. Dad, too." He nodded. "I don't want her to die," I said. It was the first time I'd ever contemplated such a thing, and it scared me. We didn't have much as a family, but we'd always had one another. Even though she was younger and didn't explore like my brother and me, my sister had already taken on the best aspects of my mother's personality. She had a perennially sunny disposition. She laughed and smiled, and on those days when I wasn't tagging along with my brother, she was my best friend. Like me, she loved the Johnny West set, and at night we would play together for hours. My brother and I were a curious and sad sight in the parking lot. Strangers would see us as they got out of the car on their way to visit someone inside. Hours later, when they came back out, we'd still be sitting in the same spot. A few people offered to buy us a soda or something to eat, but we'd shake our heads and say that we were fine. We'd been taught never to take anything from strangers. Later in the afternoon, while my brother was climbing in the tree, he lost his grip and fell to the pavement. Landing on his wrist, he screamed, and as he held it before me, I saw it begin to swell and slowly turn black and blue. We wondered aloud whether it was broken. We wondered whether we should disobey our mom and head into the hospital to tell her about it, and whether it might even need a cast. We didn't move, though. We couldn't. In the end, my sister would recover, and we'd learn that Micah's wrist was sprained, not broken. But at the time, we knew nothing. Instead, we sat together with fear in our hearts, just the two of us, not saying much to each other the rest of the afternoon. Chapter 4. After listening to Micah's admonition about cheating myself of the excitement about our trip around the world, I hung up the phone thinking about what he'd said. What Kathy had been saying, what my agent had been saying, what everyone, in fact, had been saying about the trip whenever I'd mentioned it. Despite the logical arguments, despite the fact that it had been my idea to go, I still couldn't summon any excitement about the trip. It's not that I spent my days under a cloud of doom and gloom. Yes, I was busy, but to be honest, I found tremendous satisfaction in all that I was doing. My wife was right. I was busy because I liked being busy. Perhaps, I mused, the problem was that all my energies were focused in only three areas: father, husband, and writer, with little time for anything else. As long as things fit into these neat little boxes that I'd constructed for myself, I felt in control. Not only could I function, but I could thrive. But because it was all I could do to keep up in these three areas, the idea of stepping outside the boxes to do new things, travel, adventure, or spending 3 weeks with my brother, not only seemed impossible, but struck me as a trade-off I would regret. And in a rare moment of clarity in an otherwise foggy year, I suddenly realized that I had begun to take this to extremes. If I couldn't even find excitement in the idea of taking a trip around the world, what kind of person was I? I wasn't sure. All I knew was that I didn't want to stay that way forever. Somehow I needed to find my balance again. Of course, there are thousands of books and talk shows offering ways to straighten out your life, and experts of every variety claim to have the answers. Instinctively, though, I wanted to figure things out with the help of the one person in my life who had lived through the same things I had, my brother. Micah had had his own struggles over the last 3 years, particularly about his faith. For the most part, he'd abandoned prayer, and discussing faith had become uncomfortable to him. His wife Christine had talked to me about her concerns a couple of times. She was devout in her Christian beliefs, as Micah himself had once been. And I slowly began to realize that somehow there was a chance we could help each other. And in that way, I began to think of the trip less as a journey around the world than a journey to rediscover who I was and how I developed the way I had. When I reflected on my childhood, I usually recalled it as light without shadow, as if the dark edges never existed, or if they did, they were something to be reveled in, like badges of honor. Dangerous events were transformed over the years into humorous anecdotes. Painful moments were modified into sweet tales of innocence. In the past, when asked about my parents, I usually responded that my mom and dad were both ordinary and typical, as was my childhood. Lately, however, I've come to realize that while my comments were true in some ways, they rang false in others. And it wasn't until I had children of my own that I finally began to understand the daily pressures that must have plagued both of them. Parenthood is fraught with worry, and my parents, despite the long leash they gave us, no doubt worried about us frequently. But if raising children is difficult, I've learned that marriage is sometimes even more challenging. And in this, my parents was no exception. By early 1972, my parents were struggling to keep their household intact. We were children and were unaware of the details. All we knew was that my dad had begun whistling all the time. And by then, it had begun to take on ominous significance. The sound of those nameless melodies, with their pitch rising and falling, was the first of the warning signs of my father's anger that we children grew to recognize. DEFCON 1, if you will. In DEFCON 2, mumbling would be added to the whistling, and my dad would pace in circles, refusing to talk to anyone. DEFCON 3 was indicated by the actual thinning of his lips, and in DEFCON 4, his face would begin turning red. He was sometimes able to halt the eventual progression toward nuclear launch. But if he ever hit DEFCON 5, where he would curl his tongue against his bottom teeth so that his tongue protruded from his mouth, held in place with his top teeth, we kids knew our best option was one of two things: run or hide. We knew he'd be reaching for his belt, which had replaced the fly swatter as the instrument of punishment. Those moments, while still rare, were growing more frequent. Looking back, I can't say that I blame him. In 1963, he was a young, recently married, starving student. 9 years later, he was still a starving student, only with the added responsibility of providing for a family of five. Working had slowed his education to a glacial pace, and trying to write a dissertation with the three of us using the apartment as our playground in the evenings was enough to drive anyone nuts. My mom, on the other hand, continued to adore us unequivocally. When we tagged along with her to the store or she brought us to church, she was quick to display her pride to anyone who happened to be nearby. She had an uncanny ability to forget how rotten we were at times, but her ability to forgive was tempered by the same toughness she'd forever been instilling in us. As wild as we got, as far afield as we roamed, there was never a doubt in either my brother's mind or mine exactly who was in charge. If Mom said to be home by dinner, we were home. If she said to clean up our bedroom, we did so right away. And if we happened to make a mistake, she'd make sure that we corrected it. She also defended us like a mother bear when she felt it was merited. When a teacher slapped Micah at school, my mom stormed in that afternoon, dragging Micah and me behind her. "If you ever slap my child again, I'll call the police and have you arrested. You will not touch my child." On the way out, Micah and I strutted like roosters, thinking, "Take that, you old bat. My mom showed you who's boss." "You're the best mom," Micah preened. My mom whirled around and brought a finger to his face. "Don't think for a second that I don't know why she slapped you. You probably deserved it. And if you ever talk back to her like that again, I'll show you what a real slap feels like." "Okay, Mom. You know I love you, right?" "Yes, Mom." "You know I'll always stand up for you, right?" "Yes, Mom. But I'm still disappointed in you. And you'll be grounded for this." Micah was grounded, but the disappointment hurt worse. We hated to disappoint her. Despite the pressures my parents were under, my dad gradually became more comfortable with us as we grew older. At times he would let us crawl up into his lap as he watched old horror movies on television. He absolutely loved horror movies, and we came to treasure these moments, pining for them like the exquisite morsels they were. Naturally, we became extremely knowledgeable in the proper ways to kill vampires and werewolves in the event that our family was ever confronted by such a being. My brother and I had carved a collection of wooden stakes out of popsicle sticks, which we kept under the bed. In ever rarer quiet moments, my dad used to play the guitar for us as well. His sound was fluid and assured, and one evening he surprised us by telling us that he'd once been in a band. The thought of my father in a band was fairly heady stuff. It meant that our dad not only had magic powers, but was cool. And of the two, this was of greater importance to us. We knew, after all, that we were cool, and we thought our parents were too. But now, we had proof. We like to imagine our dad playing before screaming crowds, the kind we saw on television when the Beatles played. We even had long conversations about it, but our dad simply laughed when we asked him how he'd been able to fend all those girls off. My band wasn't quite that popular, he tried to explain, but we didn't believe him. Why should we? The facts, after all, were clear. He was in a band, he sang and played like a professional, and he used to live in England. What could be more obvious? After a while, I think we actually convinced ourselves that he not only knew Paul McCartney and John Lennon personally, but had played no small role in their success. And he was our dad. Aside from watching spooky movies, listening to him play became our favorite activity with him. Usually, we'd be goofing off in the living room when we'd hear him start tuning his guitar. This was our signal to calm down, and we'd quickly take our places at his feet. He never rushed. He always made sure the guitar's pitch was perfect. He seldom sang right away. I think he was shy. But instead would simply strum through a few songs, tapping his foot in time. His fingers moved amazingly fast, as if guided by unknown forces, and when he looked at us, he'd smile, occasionally waggling his eyebrows. Eventually he would sing, and we'd listen raptly for as long as he did. And when he finally got around to playing something by the Beatles, my brother, sister, and I would glance knowingly at one another, sharing the same thought. See, I told you he knew them. Perhaps responding to the rising tension in the house, by that time my parents had begun arguing about everything from money to my dad's emotional absence in our lives, arguments that frequently left my mom in tears, my mom began coming into our room at bedtime, where she'd lie down with each of us in succession. Though I didn't understand it at the time, back then it simply seemed to be another way to show her love for us, I now think she used those moments to escape the stress of her marriage, if only for a short while. While in bed, she'd ask each of us about our day, and we'd whisper our answers, sharing whatever happened to be on our minds. We'd talk about God or school or friends, and though she'd sometimes speak, more often than not she'd simply let us ramble on, jumping from one subject to the next. She was warm and soft like a heated pillow, and those stolen moments felt like heaven itself. Later, my dad would finally come to tuck us in. Most of the time, since he got home so late, we'd already be asleep. But I always woke as soon as the door creaked open and the light from the hallway spilled in. Sometimes I pretended that I hadn't heard him just to see what he would do. But my dad had a routine he always followed, whether we were sleeping or not. He went from one bed to the next, pulling the covers up before gently stroking our hair. Then he'd stand over us for a moment before finally leaning down to kiss us on the cheek. By the end of the day, he looked tired, and his whiskers felt like rough sandpaper. He smelled like Old Spice and cigarettes. And in a quiet voice he'd whisper, "I love you," to each of us. Only then would my day finally feel complete, warm and comforted. I wouldn't wake again for the rest of the night. That year, perhaps because our parents understood how their arguments were affecting their children, we experienced the only miracle of our young lives. I woke to find my sister nudging me awake early one morning. "Come quick," she said. "You're not going to believe what I just saw." "What is it?" "Come on," she urged. "Hurry, I already woke up Micah." Rubbing my eyes, I hurried from the room, following my brother and sister. All of a sudden, they stopped, and when Micah turned, I saw his eyes widen in shock. He pointed to the kitchen table. I followed his gaze, and for a moment, all I could do was blink. There, right in the middle of the table, were two plastic swords and a plastic crown. Brand new toys. "Why are there toys there?" I asked. "What could it mean?" Dana asked. "It doesn't make sense," Micah added. "It's not Christmas or a birthday." We pulled up our chairs and stared at them. Of course we wanted to touch them, but we didn't. We couldn't. Their unexpected arrival left us stunned. "Do you think Mom or Dad got them for someone else's birthday party?" I asked. "I don't think so," Micah answered. "Maybe they're for us," Dana volunteered. "Don't be ridiculous. Parents don't buy things for their kids for no reason," Micah said quickly. Yeah, Dana, I added. It's like a rule or something. But there they were before us, taunting us. What if they were for us? No, it was impossible. The sword was calling to me. It would be so easy to touch, and my hand began to creep forward. Don't, Micah warned. Mom and Dad will get mad if you touch it. I think they're for us, Dana said again. No, they're not, Micah said. But he couldn't take his eyes off the new toys either. Dana, too, continued to stare. Maybe we should go ask Mom and Dad, Dana said. I'm not going in their bedroom, Micah said. They're sleeping. You know how mad they get if we wake them up. I'm not going in there either, I said, shaking my head. I'll go, Dana said, rising from the table. With only the slightest hesitation, she disappeared into our parents' bedroom. That's a brave girl, Micah said. I hope she doesn't get in too much trouble, I whispered. We waited for the shouts, but strangely none came. Dana appeared outside the door, closed it behind her, and crept back down the hall. Were they still sleeping? Dana shook her head excitedly as she approached the table. No, Mom was awake. She said the toys were for us. She said Dad brought them home for us. For a moment, all I could do was stare. I'd heard what she said, but couldn't bring myself to believe it. No way! That's what she said. So we can play with them? I guess so. Are you sure? You've got to be sure about this, Dana. Mom told me, she insisted. Our eyes swiveled back to the table, and with trembling hands we reached for them. The sword was light in my hands. It was brand new, and we got it for nothing. Dana took the crown and gently placed it on her head. Micah took the other sword and stood from the table. He swooshed it through the air and smiled. Come on, he cried. Let's go outside and play. What do you want to play? Dana asked. You be the princess and we'll be the knights, and we'll protect you. From what? Dana asked. From the dragons and the bad guys. Come on, let's go find a fort. Shouldn't we get dressed first? We're still in our pajamas. We will in a little while, Micah said, not bothering to hide his impatience. Let's go play first, and remember, since you asked Mom and Dad, you can give us orders. We'll protect you. So that's what we did. We played for hours, protecting our sister from harm. Micah and I slew countless imaginary creatures. Dana called us Sir Micah and Sir Nicky, and we saved her life 100 times that day. In real life, she had almost died once. In our imagination, we would never let it happen again. On the way home, she held both our hands. I'll always be safe with my knight, she told us. I love you both so much. For weeks afterward, her nicknames for us lingered. And in the same way that our parents seemed to shelter Dana from harm, both Micah and I began to feel the need to do so too. Unlike us, she was quiet and sweet. Unlike us, she seemed content with the world around her. Dana was our princess, and we decided then and there that we would always take care of her. As the year wore on, my parents continued to argue even more. Usually these fights would occur late at night after we'd gone to bed. We'd be sleeping soundly when their raised voices would wake us. One by one, my brother, my sister, and I would sit up in our beds and listen. But with every shout, we'd flinch and look at each other, wishing that it would stop, and wanting nothing more than for them to be happy again. The fights could last for an hour or more. Over and over, Dana and I looked to Micah for answers. But this was a world beyond even his understanding. Why are they fighting? Dana might ask. I don't know, Micah would answer. Who started it? I'd chime in. I don't think grown-ups fight like that. I think they start at the same time. Why don't they just kiss each other and stop being mad? Dana fretted. I don't know. Should we say a prayer? Micah would nod, and we'd pray, and then we'd listen, trying to see if our prayers had been answered. Sometimes they would. Sometimes they wouldn't. But either way, we'd finally force ourselves to lie down again. Staring at the ceiling, we'd watch the shadows, feeling more frightened than we'd ever felt while watching one of my dad's horror movies. Chapter 5. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, January 22nd to 23rd. During the days leading up to the trip, my wife and I began shopping for the items I would need to take with me. TCS had requested that we pack everything into a single suitcase, informing us that it was best to prepare for all types of weather. This was easier said than done, considering we were going to be in the southern hemisphere in the summer, where temperatures in Australia would probably exceed 100 degrees, and 300 miles above the Arctic Circle in the middle of winter when we finally finished in Norway. Then there were toiletry items, most of which were easily accessible in the United States, but less so in foreign countries such as Cambodia or Ethiopia, two countries in which the median income was less than $500 a year. In the end, I brought 3 pairs of pants, 3 pairs of shorts, and 6 shirts, in addition to undergarments and everything else I thought I needed. I got a pair of rugged walking shoes made of leather and Gore-Tex. I'd also made arrangements to rent a satellite phone for use on the trip, but I'd been warned that it wasn't always dependable. Because of the exotic locations, varying topographies, and the ever-changing position of the satellite overhead, receiving calls would be mostly impossible. And though I would be able to call Kathy, the ever-changing time zones and flights would make it difficult to stay in touch on a regular basis. Everything fit into the suitcase and carry-on with room to spare, since I knew I'd be picking up souvenirs along the way. My workload hadn't diminished at all. A novel that should already have been delivered was only half completed, and I had no idea where to take the story next. The feeling had begun to haunt me to the point that I couldn't sleep at night, but I promised Kat that I wasn't going to work on it. Nonetheless, I slipped a notebook into the suitcase just in case I changed my mind. During the last week, I spent as much time as I could with the kids, trying my best to forget the fact that it was only leaving me further behind in my work. Kat and I went out for a farewell dinner the night before my departure. At noon the following day, she drove me to the airport. Though the trip around the world wouldn't commence until Friday, January 24th, my brother and I were flying to Fort Lauderdale 2 days early and planned to meet at the airport. "So this is it," I said, trying to summon enthusiasm for the trip. Despite my epiphany, I still wasn't looking forward to going. By then, I suppose my ambivalence had become a habit. "You have everything, right?" Kat asked. "Passport, phone, cash." "Got it all," I said. She nodded. "Have a good time," she said. "I'll try." "No," she said patiently. "Have a good time." I gave her a hug. "I love you, Kat." "I love you, too." "Kiss the kids for me every night?" "I will." "Try not to work too hard while I'm gone." She laughed, about to say the same thing to me. "You owe me for this, you know. You can't believe how much you owe me." "I know," I said. "I'm sure I'll be ignoring the credit card bills for months." "More like years," she said, "or even decades." We kissed one last time. During my flight, all I could do was think about her, and how lucky I was to have married her. Visions of the trip never entered my mind at all. A couple of hours later, I arrived in Fort Lauderdale under sunny skies, retrieved my luggage, and waited for my brother in the baggage section of the airport. I called Kat to tell her I made it, then took a seat on one of the benches waiting for him. A half hour later, Micah wasn't hard to spot walking through the airport. Tall and blonde, he had a tendency to stand out in a crowd. As soon as he spotted me from across the baggage terminal, he thrust his arms above his head. I knew what was coming and cringed. "Nikki, my brother, I have finally arrived and the festivities can begin." His voice boomed in the terminal. Strangers gawked and turned to me in shock. I felt their eyes focusing on me. "Obviously my brother doesn't get out much," I murmured. A few moments later, amid a crowd that had suddenly given us plenty of room, we were hugging. "You seem to be feeling pretty good, Micah." "Had a couple of cocktails on the plane," he said easily. "Getting in the proper mood." As soon as we separated, his eyes seemed to light up even more. "Can you believe we're really going?" he asked. "In 2 days, our adventure begins." He put his hand on my shoulder. "You getting excited yet?"
"Of course."
"No, you're not. This," he said, motioning to himself, "is what excited looks like. You don't look excited."
"I'm excited on the inside." He rolled his eyes.
"How was your flight?"
"Good. And yours?"
"It was great. Sat next to a couple of neat people. I told them all about the trip. They couldn't believe it. Have you called Kat to tell her you made it?"
I nodded.
"Yeah, we just talked a few minutes ago. Do you want to call Christine?"
"I will in a little while. I need to unwind first, stretch my legs for a while. I gotta stay in shape, you know. I'm gonna do quite a bit of hiking over the next few weeks."
"You are?"
"Didn't I tell you?" His voice began to rise as he went on.
"I'm going around the world with my brother."
The crowd parted even more, some of them looking frightened now.
"Hey, you hungry?" he suddenly asked.
"A little."
"Well, I'm starved. You want to get something to eat after we drop our luggage off at the hotel?"
You got it.
The luggage carousel finally lurched to life, and I was busy scanning the assorted suitcases for his luggage when suddenly he pointed.
There it is, the red one.
It was undoubtedly the largest suitcase I'd ever seen. Absolutely massive. At least twice the size of mine. It was straining at the seams and bulging in the middle. Micah needed both hands and a couple of grunts to retrieve it. When he set it upright so that it could be wheeled, it seemed to spread even wider.
Okay, I'm ready, he said, satisfied. Let's go.
Are you sure you brought enough?
Got everything I need.
I stared at the suitcase. It looks like you packed a small farm animal in there. One thing I've learned is that you can never bring too much stuff when you're traveling. I always thought the opposite was true.
He winked. No, that's just a myth put out by the airlines. Don't believe it. When you run out of things on the trip, don't worry. I'll be happy to share.
We found a restaurant in downtown Fort Lauderdale where we ate outside and watched people wander in and out of bars up and down the street. We bantered back and forth until finally Micah paused. Leaning back in his chair, he squinted at me.
You're still not into this, are you? What we're doing, I mean.
I'm getting there. Did you ever think you might be depressed?
I'm not depressed, just busy.
It runs in our family, you know. Some of our relatives are depressed.
I'm not depressed.
They have medication now. It might do you some good.
I don't need medication.
Denial is an ugly thing, Nikki.
I'm not in denial.
See what I mean? That's denial.
You're a pain, you know that?
Yeah, that's what Christine says.
She's a smart lady.
That she is, but she's not here, and right now we're talking about you, so why are you depressed, little brother? You're definitely not excited about this, and we're on the verge of leaving. Talk to me, I'll be your shrink.
I'm not depressed, I said again.
Like I said, I'm swamped. You have no idea how busy I've been. It's just not the right time for something like this.
That's not true, he said, shaking his head.
You're choosing to let life control you instead of the other way around. That's the big secret. You choose the kind of life you want to live.
You always say that.
Only because it's true. Using you as an example. You're busy because you're behind on all your deadlines and want to catch up, right?
Exactly.
But what if you missed your deadline? It's not as if you're going to get fired, are you?
No, but...
But you think bad things will happen if you do, he finished for me. So in other words, you're making a choice. And if it's your choice, then accept it. But don't let it control you. In the same way, you can choose to be excited about the trip. That's entirely up to you. I looked away, shaking my head.
It's not always that easy, I said slowly. You don't choose everything. Sometimes life throws you curveballs.
You don't think I know that? He said softly.
Look, just so you know, this trip is going to be great. You just wait. After all this is over, you'll look back and be glad you came. And then you'll thank me for bringing you along.
I invited you to come, remember?
Oh, yeah, you're right, he shrugged.
Well, in that case, be a good host and stop ruining my buzz. He turned to get the waitress's attention.
This man needs a cocktail.
Despite myself, I laughed. Maybe it was my brother's pep talk, or maybe it was the cocktail, but whatever the reason, I gradually warmed to the idea of going. Whether I had time to go was now irrelevant, after all, and my brother's good mood was infectious. My brother has always had this effect on me. With his confidence and easygoing manner, he has always been a hit at parties, and he'd been the best man in 6 different weddings. 6. The next day we went by the reception room TCS had arranged to check in for the trip. We signed in, gave them our passports, and got our luggage tags. Each was large, pink, and numbered so that the TCS crew could easily make sure every bag was accounted for. One of the nice things about the trip, we would later learn, is that TCS handled all the luggage. Our only responsibility would be to have the luggage outside our hotel room at the appointed time. We spent the afternoon relaxing by the pool, and later that evening we attended an introductory cocktail party and dinner. It was our first chance to meet our fellow travelers. There would be 86 of us on the trip, most of whom were considerably older than Micah or I. We began the gradual process of getting to know our traveling companions. We mingled and chatted with a few people and eventually made our way to the ballroom where tables had been set up. As we ate, we were introduced to the TCS staff. Quite a few would be traveling with us to make sure everything went smoothly. We were introduced to guest lecturers and Jill Hanna, the physician who would attend to any medical issues that might arise. only a couple of years older than we were, she smiled easily and would end up becoming one of our closest friends on the trip. Auspiciously, she was seated at our table. "Any words of advice?" I asked her. "Don't eat the vegetables or salads, no matter how nice the hotel is." "Because of the fertilizers or soil?" "No," she said, "because they wash them in the local water and you never know whether it's been purified." "Anything else?" "Don't use the tap when you brush your teeth either." "Take these precautions and you'll probably be fine. I'm going to say the same thing to the rest of the group later when it's my turn to talk. But just wait. Half these people won't listen and they'll end up sick. You don't want to be sick when you travel like this. Trust me, it's no fun." As she spoke, I could see her eyes darting from me to Micah and back to me again. "You guys are brothers, right?" We nodded. "Twins?" "We get that quite a bit, actually." I shook my head. "No." "But you're older, right?" "No, he is," I grimaced. Micah leaned in, looking inordinately pleased by her comment. Micah enjoyed the fact that nearly everyone thought he was younger than I when they saw us together. "I've always told him he should take better care of himself," he chided. She smiled. "Are you guys married?" "We both are," I answered. "Why did you come together and not with your wives?" We explained about our children and showed her pictures of our families. Finally, she looked up at us again. "I think it's great that you two are doing this together. Siblings aren't always as close as they should be." "Were you always this close?" I hesitated. "Not always," I finally admitted. In 1973, halfway through the school year, we moved to Grand Island, Nebraska. Or rather, everyone in the family except my dad moved. At the time, my mom told us that we were leaving so that my dad would be able to finish his dissertation. And we moved into a small duplex just around the corner from my mom's parents' house. While my dad did indeed finish his dissertation that year, he and my mother had in fact separated. It was years, however, before we ever learned the truth about this. My mom was not above keeping secrets from us if she thought the truth would hurt us. Grand Island was a sleepy little town nestled in the middle of the state and as different from Los Angeles as a place could be. Wide yards separated the homes, and directly across the street from my grandparents was the elementary school we'd attend. Unlike the schools we'd been attending, Gates Elementary had massive grass fields, baseball diamonds, and, on the far side just off the school property, a set of train tracks where trains would come by regularly. It didn't take long before my brother and I were laying pennies and nickels on the tracks, waiting for the trains to crush and flatten them. But unlike Los Angeles, there wasn't much else to do in the way of exploring or getting in trouble. There weren't any vacant, burned-out buildings in which we could build forts. There were no bridges to climb, and though there were ravens, none of them ever attacked us. As she had in Los Angeles, my mom got a job, this time as an optometrist assistant, and after school we'd head to my grandparents. There, my grandmother would make us chocolate malts and cinnamon toast, the most exquisite afternoon snack in the world. And we'd either play in the yard or go down to the basement where my Uncle Joe kept his collection of model airplanes. There were probably over 100 models, including Spitfires and Japanese Zeros, and my uncle had assembled them as if they would someday hang in a museum. They were painted in exacting, excruciating detail, and though we weren't allowed to touch them, we spent hours looking at them. Entering a new school halfway through the year is always hard, and for the first couple of weeks, my brother and I spent most afternoons together as we had in Los Angeles. We discovered the parks and rode our bikes there. More often than not, we'd see dozens of other kids playing games, some of whom were in our classes. A month later, they would all be there again, sledding down the hills. But by that age, the differences between us were becoming apparent. Micah was taller, stronger, and more athletic than I, and seemed to fear nothing. He viewed the move as a new adventure, made friends easily, and carried himself with a confidence that I found elusive. I had always been smaller and less athletic and more insecure than he. And I worried constantly. I worried about getting in trouble, I worried about getting good grades, and I worried what other people thought about me. I worried about doing the right thing and playing with the right kind of kids. Though I did indeed make new friends, it took far longer for me to adjust to my new surroundings. As spring overtook winter, Micah seemed to have less and less need for my companionship, and when I tried to tag along with him, he began treating me as a nuisance. Instead, Micah would pal around with Kurt Grimminger, a boy in his class whose family owned a farm just outside town. He would go there almost every afternoon, and they would spend hours wrestling in the corn silo, riding tractors and horses, and harassing the pigs and cows with BB guns. At home, Micah would regale us with one exciting story after the next over dinner. I couldn't help feeling envious, for no matter what I had done during the day, nothing ever seemed to be as exciting as what he was doing. Around that time, we had our first fight. I can't remember what we'd been arguing about, but one thing led to the next, and fists were flying. He punched me in the stomach, knocking the wind out of me, and slammed me to the ground. Soon he was on top of me and hitting me over and over. I was helpless to defend myself, absorbing blow after blow. The next thing I remember is the sound of my mother screaming. Jerking Micah up, she swatted him before sending him to his room. He skulked off toward the house, and as I struggled to my feet, my mom reached for my arm. "What happened?" "He hates me," I cried. Even then, I didn't know whether my pain or humiliation was worse, and when my mom tried to comfort me, I shook her hand from my arm. "Leave me alone!" Turning away, I began to run. I didn't know where I was going. All I knew was that I didn't want to talk to anyone. I didn't want to see anyone. I didn't want to be small. I didn't want to live in Nebraska. I didn't want anyone's pity. All I wanted was for things to be the way they used to be, and I kept going and going as if somehow hoping to make time move in reverse. Later, I found myself at the railroad tracks, some distance from home. I sat beneath a tree watching for the train. The trains were always on schedule, and I knew that another train would follow an hour after the next. I told myself that I would stay until both of them went by, but when they did, I barely noticed them. Instead, I sat with my face in my hands, shoulders quaking, wishing that our fight had never happened, and crying as I'd never cried before. I could feel my family's eyes on me when I finally walked in the door. By then it was dark and everyone was seated at the table, but my mom seemed to understand that I wasn't hungry, and she simply nodded when I asked if it was okay if I could go to my room, or rather, our room. Again, the three of us were sharing a room, and in the darkness I lay down on my bed and stared at the ceiling. While my anger had subsided, I was confused. I told myself that I wanted to be alone, that it was better for me to handle my feelings in my own way. Yet I couldn't shake the desire I had for my mother to come into the room. Like most children, I believed that attention somehow equaled love, and of the three children, I got less of the former, implying less of the latter. Micah, after all, had always been treated like an adult, and because he was the first to experience everything from walking to talking to getting into trouble, he received the attention granted to those who occupy the head of the line. My sister, on the other hand, both the youngest and the only girl, was accorded almost double privileges. She spent more time with my mom than either my brother or I, had fewer chores, seldom got in trouble, and was the only one of us who got more than one pair of shoes at a time, the reason being, she's a girl. More often than not, I was beginning to feel left out. The knock didn't come for an hour, and by then I was feeling downright sorry for myself. "Come in," I said, and sitting up in bed, I wondered what my mom was going to say. When the door opened, however, it wasn't my mom who entered the room. Instead, it was Dana. "Hi," she said. "Oh, hey," I said, glancing over her shoulder. "Is Mom coming?" "I don't know." "She wanted me to ask you if you were hungry." "No," I lied. My sister came and sat on the bed. With long sandy blonde hair parted in the middle, pale skin and freckles, she looked like Jan Brady on the early episodes of the Brady Bunch. "Does your stomach hurt?" "No." "Are you still mad at Micah?" "No, I don't even care about him anymore." "Oh. I mean, he doesn't care about me, right?" "Right. And neither does Mom." "She does, too. Mom loves you." "Did she worry about me while I was gone?" "No, she knew you were fine, but she does love you." My shoulders slumped. "No one loves me." "I love you." Though my sister sounded utterly sincere, I wasn't in any mood to hear it. "Gee, thanks." "That's not why I came in here, though. To tell you that, I mean." "I said I wasn't hungry." "I didn't come to tell you that either." "Why did you come in then?" She put her arm around me. "I came to tell you that if Micah doesn't want to be your best friend anymore, I'd be happy to be your best friend. I don't need a friend." "Okay." I looked around the room before finally sighing. "Want to play with the Johnny West set?" She smiled. "Okay." Over the next couple of months, while Micah spent time with his friends, my sister and I began to spend more time together. She wasn't as exciting as Micah, but while she never wanted to jump out of tall trees, she was amazingly easy to get along with. Still, I was occasionally too rough with her, and every so often she would end up crying, and I'd beg her not to tell Mom. She would, though. Dana told my mom everything, and even though she didn't intend for me to get into trouble, I'd often end up doing extra chores while my mom watched me with a frown. Without my father around, and the terror implied by the ever-present DEFCON countdown, my brother began testing his limits. He stayed out later than he should have, began picking on me even more, talked back to my mom, and pretty much began acting like a teenager at the ripe old age of 9. This couldn't have been easy for my mom. She was 30 years old, working full-time, and alone. The last thing she needed was any additional, as opposed to the regular and allowable, stress from the three of us. She began clamping down on Micah, who began talking back even more. But at 9, my brother was no match for my mom. She believed in both the carrot and the stick and wielded them expertly, like a samurai using a sword. She had no qualms with saying things like, "I brought you into this world and I sure as hell can take you out," and then acting sweet as sugar a moment later, arms open for a hug. Nor has she changed her views on sibling affection. For example, while my mom was pleased that my sister and I were spending more time together, she also recognized that things had changed between Micah and me. Though some parents would have considered our newfound sibling rivalry a passing phase, my mom didn't like it, nor was she willing to put up with it. She began making comments like, "You three will always have each other, so you'd better be nice now," and, "Friends come and go, but brothers and sisters always stick together." Though my brother and I listened, and perhaps even understood her words on an instinctive level, we continued to argue and fight and go our separate ways. One night, however, my mom came into our room just as we were getting ready for bed. Micah and I had been in another fight earlier in the day, this time because I'd accidentally knocked his bike over. My mom hadn't said anything about it over dinner, and I suppose she had just chosen to ignore it this time. She helped us with our prayers, as she always did. Then, as she turned the lights out, she sat beside Micah as he was crawling under the covers. I heard them whispering for what seemed like a long time and wondered what was going on. Then, surprising me, she came and sat beside me. Leaning close, she ran her hand through my hair and smiled gently. Then she whispered, "Tell me 3 nice things that Dana did for you today. Anything. It can be big or little." I was surprised by her question, but the answers came easily. She played games with me, she let me watch my show on television, and she helped me clean up my toys. Mom smiled. "Now tell me 3 nice things that Micah did for you today." This, I had to admit, was a little harder. "He didn't do anything nice for me today." "Think about it. It can be anything." "He was mean all day." "Didn't he walk with you to school?" "Yes." "So there's one. Now think of 2 more." "He didn't punch me too hard when I knocked over his bike." She wasn't sure whether to take that one, but finally nodded. "There's 2. And?" I was stumped. There was nothing, absolutely nothing else to say. It took a long time for me to come up with something, and I had no idea what I eventually came up with. I think I resorted to making up something, but my mom accepted it and kissed me goodnight before moving to my sister's bed. It took my sister no more than 10 seconds to answer the same questions, and then my mom crept from the room. In the darkness, I was rolling over and closing my eyes when I heard Micah's voice. "Nikki?"
"What?"
"I'm sorry about punching you today."
"It's okay."
"And I'm sorry about knocking over your bike." For a moment, there was silence, until Dana chimed in.
"Now don't you both feel better?"
Night after night, my mom had us name 3 nice things our siblings had done for us. And each night, we were somehow able to come up with something. And, to my surprise, my brother and I began to argue less and less. Perhaps it was too hard to make up things. After a while, it just seemed easier not only to be kinder, but to notice when another was being kind to you. We finished out the school year. I completed 2nd grade, Micah 3rd. In June, my grandfather decided to put a new roof on his house, an endeavor he decided Micah and I would help with. Our knowledge of roofing and experience with tools could be summed up in a single word. Huh? But we quickly knew we wouldn't let that stop us. It was, after all, something new, another adventure. And over the course of a couple of weeks, we learned the art of pounding nails until our hands and fingers blistered. We worked during one of the nastiest heat waves of our young lives. The temperature was close to 100 degrees, the humidity unbearable. More than once, we grew dizzy sitting up on the roof of the baking house. My grandfather had no qualms about having us work right near the edge of the roof, and we, of course, had no qualms about it either. While I escaped unscathed, earning $7 for 2 weeks' worth of work, my brother was less fortunate. One afternoon, while taking a break, he decided to move the ladder since it seemed to be in the way. What he didn't know was that a shingle cutter, a sharp, heavy, scissor-like tool, had been left on the uppermost rung. As he fumbled with the ladder, the shingle cutter was dislodged and came torpedoing down. It struck him an inch or so above his forehead. Within seconds, blood was gushing out of his head. He screamed and my grandfather hustled over. "That looks pretty deep," he said, his face grim. After a moment, he nodded. "I'd better get the hose." Soon, water was pouring through the hose over my brother's head. That, by the way, was the sum total of his medical treatment that day. He wasn't taken to the doctor or the hospital. Nor did Micah get the rest of the day off. I remember watching the water turn pink as it flowed over the wound, thankful that Micah had a thick skull like me. By the time school resumed in the fall, I'd finally become used to life in Nebraska. I was doing well in school, to that point I'd never received a grade lower than an A, and had become friends with a few of the other kids in class. Afternoons were spent playing football, but as summer heat gradually began giving way to autumn chill, our life would be upended once more. "We're moving back to California," my mom informed us over dinner one night. "We'll be leaving a couple of weeks before Christmas." My parents had reconciled, though at the time we weren't even aware that they'd officially separated, and my dad had taken a job as a professor at California State University at Sacramento, where he would teach classes in management. Our time in Nebraska came to an end, as abruptly as it had begun. Chapter 6. Yasha and Tikal, Guatemala. January 24th to 25th. On Friday morning, Micah and I touched down in Guatemala and stepped into a world completely different from the one we had just left. After passing through customs, the tour group boarded vans and drove toward Catane, passing ramshackle houses and small villages that seemed to have been assembled with random bits and pieces of material. In some ways, it was like stepping back in time, and I tried to imagine what the Spanish conquistadors first thought when they arrived in this area. They were the first to discover the ruins of what was once a flourishing civilization, whose large cities included temples rising as high as 230 feet and silhouetted against the dense jungle foliage. I'd been interested in the Maya since I first read about them as a child, and knew they'd attained intellectual heights unrivaled in the New World. In their golden age, from AD 300 to 900, their civilization encompassed the area including the Yucatan Peninsula, southern Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, parts of Honduras, and El Salvador. The culture reached its height amid the jungles and swamps of Petén, Guatemala, where they built the cities of Yasha and Tikal. The civilization was a study in contrasts. A sometimes brutal culture that engaged in human sacrifice, the Maya were simultaneously employing the concept of zero 1,000 years before the Europeans, and were able to calculate into the hundreds of millions. Their knowledge of mathematics allowed them to chart the stars, accurately predict lunar eclipses, and develop a 365-day calendar, yet legend has it that they never used the wheel. We arrived at the Maya biosphere, the vast national park in Petén that was home to the ruins, where we had lunch in an open-air hut along the lake. We continued to acquaint ourselves with our companions, most of whom had traveled far more extensively than either Micah or I. An hour later, we were back on the road again for our stop at Yasha. Yasha is both the name of a lagoon and the site of a city built more than 1,500 years ago amid the jungle along its banks. Yasha was once the third largest city in the Mayan Empire, and approximately 20 miles from Tikal, the largest and most important ceremonial city. When we arrived, however, we saw nothing but trees and dirt pathways winding among the hills. In the background we could hear howler monkeys, but the foliage above us was so thick it was impossible to see them. Our guide began talking about the city and Mayan culture while pointing in various directions. I could see nothing. As he continued, I glanced at Micah, who shrugged. When the guide asked if there were any questions, I spoke up. "When do we actually get there?" I asked. "To Yasha, I mean." "We're here now," he answered. "But where are the buildings?" I asked. He motioned to the hillsides surrounding us. "Everywhere you look," he answered. "Those are not hills, you see. Beneath each and every mound is a building or temple." The trees in this part of the jungle, we learned, shed leaves 3 times a year. Over time, as the leaves decay, they form compost, which eventually turns to dirt. The dirt allows for initial vegetation, then eventually trees. The trees grow, mature, die, and new ones grow in their place. the jungle had swallowed the buildings one by one. This news didn't surprise us. The city had been abandoned 1,000 years ago, 3,000 layers of densely packed leaves and growth, and the jungle had grown unchecked. It made sense that we would see no signs of the city. But we were wrong. In fact, sections of Yasha had been completely restored less than 80 years earlier by archaeologists in much the same way Tikal has been restored now. The jungle had been cut back and dozens of buildings and temples had been completely excavated. Yet because the rains were beginning to slowly destroy the newly uncovered temples, and because lack of funds failed to keep the destruction in check, the government had no choice but to allow the jungle to encroach once more on Yasha in favor of Tikal. Micah began looking around, his expression as wondrous as that of a child. "Can you believe that all this growth took place in only 80 years? Micah asked me. "Our grandparents were living then." "I can't believe it. I wonder what it would look like after 800 years. "Probably about the same, don't you think?" I speculated. "Except that the hills might be a little bigger." "I guess so." He squinted, trying to peer through the density of the jungle. "How on earth could someone even have discovered this place? I mean, when I see a mound of dirt, I don't automatically think there's a pyramid beneath it." I put my arm around him. "That's why you're not an archaeologist," I said. Our guide began leading us along a path, continuing to describe various aspects of the city. Micah and I trailed behind our group, our heads swiveling from side to side. Micah suddenly rubbed his hands together. It was something he always did when excited. "Nick," he said, "can you believe we're here? In a buried Mayan city in the jungles of Guatemala? 6 hours ago, we were in Fort Lauderdale eating bagels and cream cheese." "It doesn't seem real, does it?" "No," he said. "And I'll tell you something," he motioned around him. "I never believed I could get so excited about seeing a pile of dirt." A few minutes later, we entered what was once a plaza. Before us was one of the only temples that had been fully excavated. And for the first time, the reality of what we would see on the trip took hold. Shaped like a black, gray trapezoid, the temple towered 100 feet in the air. Our guide informed us that it had been abandoned in roughly A.D. 900, some 600 years before Columbus arrived. It meant that the time between the usage of the temple and Columbus's arrival and the current day were roughly the same. And the very thought amazed me. In the ebb and flow of history, the rise and fall of civilizations, my own daily concerns suddenly seemed minuscule in comparison. My brother, too, was examining the temple before us with great interest, though his thoughts were slightly different from mine. "Look how high it is! I've got to climb that thing!" So with our guide's permission, we did. Running up the far side of the temple was a rickety set of rotting boards, spaced irregularly and laced together with frayed rope. My brother and I were the first to reach the top, and for the first few minutes we had the place to ourselves. The sky was overcast with black clouds hovering at the distant horizon. Beyond us we could see the lagoon and the utter density of the jungle spreading 30 miles in every direction. It was impossible to see through the canopy of trees, but we saw the tops of 3 or 4 pyramids poking through as if trying to reach the heavens. And with the exception of the sound of our breathing, slightly labored from the climb, it was utterly, completely silent. The sides of the pyramid seemed to plunge straight down, and standing near the edge gave me a sense of vertigo. Yet neither Micah nor I could wipe the smiles off our faces. We had begun the trip of our lives a few hours earlier. Now we were standing on what seemed to be the top of the world, in a place we'd always dreamed of seeing. "Take my picture," Micah suddenly said. "Christine's going to love this." "If she were here, do you think she would have come up?" "No way. She hates heights." "She would have been one of those people way down there," he said, pointing to where we'd been standing. "How about Kathy?" "She doesn't like heights either, but she'd be up here. She wouldn't get too close to the edge, though." I took his picture and he took mine. We took another, then still more. And we continued to gaze in wonder, even as I retrieved the satellite phone from my backpack. "I've got to call Kat," I said, feeling the need to share this with her. I dialed the number and I heard the phone begin to ring. This amazed me. I was making a phone call from the middle of nowhere. When she answered, the first words out of my mouth were, "I'm standing on top of a Mayan temple in the jungle," and I heard Kathy whoop with the same excitement I was feeling. "Is it great?" she asked. I stared around me in wonder. "It's incredible," I said. "The only way it could be any better was if you were here beside me.
Aw, she said. I miss you too.
Later, when I hung up, Micah asked for the phone to call Christine. Unfortunately, she was out, and disappointed he hung up after leaving a message on the answering machine. A minute later, our moment of solitude ended with the arrival of the rest of the crowd. That night at the hotel,